Voices for the Networked Society, the podcast of the Weizenbaum Institute.
Welcome to the podcast of the Research Group 12, Democracy and Digitalization. My name is Weser Klute-Simon, and this episode contains a talk given by Marelle Kaufmann on the topic of hacking as a practice of disputing online surveillance. Marelle Kaufmann is a criminologist and former Weizenbaum Fellow who is particularly interested in crime and surveillance in digitalized societies. Her talk draws attention to hacking practices that interrogate the diverse faces of online surveillance. Instead of portraying hacking as a simple counterculture, she seeks to complicate the dichotomies of power versus resistance, online versus offline, and looks at the back and forth negotiation character of hacking practices. Her talk was given at 11th of June at the Weizenbaum Institute in Berlin.
Well, thanks for giving me the opportunity to present my work on hacking online surveillance. I am honored to be a fellow at the Weizenbaum Institute, and I am looking forward to a productive exchange of ideas during my stay, and specifically today. I really think it's awesome that I get to start with this talk, so you can come and rip me apart afterwards, and then you still know for the four coming weeks who I am, so you can continue doing that. So thank you to Thorsten and Lena, in specific, who host me in their groups and initiated today's talk. Now you see me, now you don't. That's an old thing that magicians said who wanted to make a disappearing act. In a sense, studying how digital surveillance is questioned has a lot to do with becoming invisible, with disappearing from view. I made interviews with hackers in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland, asking them how and why they question surveillance. I will discuss hacking as a creative form of interrogating online surveillance. Hackers do not only destroy and disrupt, surprise, surprise, but they also create in order to produce a shift in technopolitics. And this is why I ask and speak about hacking as a question or a practice of disputing online surveillance. I will first explain to you what I mean by digital dispute. As part of that, I will also briefly introduce media framings about hackers that I want to complicate. And I suggest a few more lenses than just dispute we could use to understand why hackers actually hack surveillance. And after that, I will say a few words about methodologies to study digital phenomena before I bring you to my study. And I do that because most questions asked afterwards is like, how the heck did you manage to get to speak to hackers? So this is why I'm going to take this a little bit ahead, but we can go into depth afterwards. And I will bring you to my study, its findings. And finally, I hope we have a discussion about what all these different hacking practices that I collected could actually mean. Now, I base the notion of dispute on Boltanski and Thevno. Can I see a quick hand of who? Maybe I don't do the hand thing. Okay, cool. So they describe the way in which disputes bring people and objects together to settle injustice. It requires a recognition of a so-called order of worth by all involved actors and to acknowledge the rules of debate. Think about this. I'll look at this in an online environment, right? And yet the analysis of dispute they describe mainly relates to workplace situations. The aim of such conflicts is also to be settled eventually. I want to provide a slightly different angle on these last two points that Boltanski and Thibneau make. When we understand hacking as a disputing or an act of disputing surveillance, we see that disputes can happen at a distance. I don't need to speak with you in person. They involve practices that are technologically mediated. I mean, that's what we're all here for today. Most importantly, the situation of dispute I describe is not necessarily as linear as hackers claiming injustice with the aim of resolving a conflict about surveillance. Hacking as a form of disputing surveillance is more a playful back and forth. Disputing surveillance practices can also inspire a rethinking of norms and of practices. And this is, in fact, a major aspect of hacking. And in that case, hacking is a form of dispute that is not necessarily aimed at establishing orders of worth to settle the conflict with those who exercise surveillance. Instead, it's aimed at constantly questioning and reinventing what Boltanski and Thevenot call orders of worth. I also suggest that hacking as a digital dispute is a form of critique that is internal to the system internet and therewith also to surveillance practices. It is not a critique that comes from the outside. It is not, or it does not present us with a counterpart to the internet. It's not digital detox or unfacebooking or just passive non-participation where people leave specific services or the internet entirely to go gardening or do something else. When hackers interrogate or critique valence, they stay within the system internet and a system that they partly shape themselves and that is very entangled with their sense of self, but that is also technologically fundamentally based on surveillance. So I don't present hacking as a countercultural form of fabrication, but I speak about hacking as digital dispute or internal critique. You understand it? I don't do this kind of these two things like here's one thing and then I counter it. It's a lot more involved. So I want to get away from that counter thing, right? So indeed, when we look at media and scholarly debates about hacking, we're generally confronted with simplified pictures of the hacker as either lauded or denounced, as those who confront, those who corrupt or those who protect, as criminals or as activists, as the masculine geeks that are confrontational or the female makers that hack out of care. We see them as white hats, as black hats, as blue hats. That's the guys who do it for business. So instead of being here either or, hacking does involve a large mosaic of different positions. And because of that, some scholars have begun to describe hacking, and now I quote, as different, sometimes incompatible practices. Mm-hmm. That could be pretty much anything. But I actually seek to further complicate this picture and say that we don't just find these and those types of hackers wearing different hats in different situations, but I observe that hacking as a form of dispute combines several ethics, practices, and characteristics in one. And before we go further, to explore the specific study and how I discuss hacking as a specific form of dispute, I want to broaden the picture for a moment and tell you the many reasons as to why hackers hack. This is a bit of a leeway into a different paper of mine, and I want to give you more theoretical lenses through which we can understand hacking, just to see that, you know, there's a lot of theoretical lenses through which we can understand hacking. Hackers don't necessarily see hacking as an exceptional act, but they hack as a part of their everyday life. Huh? It's an ordinary practice for them. They do it all the time. And the curiosity involved in hacking also emphasizing that hacking is a moment of analytical creativity, as I like to call it. When Miguel Sicat writes about the performative pleasure of tinkering with software to figure out what they do, he describes a moment of coded play or play with code that is also true for hacking. So the interviewees mentioned, for example, the pleasures of challenging surveillance, right? They love doing it. They don't just do it as an everyday thing, they also really enjoy what they're doing. Hacking is also a physical experience, an affective encounter. Vis-a-vis surveillance, the interviewees experience, and here I quote directly from my interviews, pressures, fear, naivete, and even creeping pain levels. Hacking is in turn associated with the excitements of self-empowerment, being constructive, but also egoistic self-protection. They elicit the joys of developing something further, being awake, and at the same time as venting anger. So you see, there's so many emotions and so many effects involved in the way in which hacking is done and what hacking actually does for hackers. Because hackers develop a lot of solutions themselves, it's also identity work, right? It's a bit of a a bit of a business card showing who you are. And it can also be thought of as a language with its very own vocabulary and grammar. I didn't really explore all of these in depth. I go through all of these lenses in one of my articles and just want to make sure that people understand hacking is not just one thing, okay? So I think we got there now. So all of these things don't necessarily mean that hacking cannot be political. Hmm? In the context of data valence, hacking is a moment of creative reflection that is deeply political. The practice of hacking, of asking questions and reappropriating infrastructures is what makes it political. And in many instances, hacking is the language of political dispute and of disagreements, which can be spoken loudly, and that's usually the ones we hear about, but it can also be spoken gently. Let's not forget that it's also spoken every day. Hmm? So I hope that we see the different dimensions of hacking now. So, how did I study hacking? I looked at hacking practices and following Bourdieu, but also Boltanski and Thebnot, I understand them as everyday practices. I also embrace the standpoint that technologies, bodies, and identities co-constitute hacking practices. It's not just one kind of thing. Technologies and their results and their users influence each other. This also means that some of these co-constituted practices do not exactly work effortlessly. And some hackers do not come about, or some hacks do not come about as intended. So the point is, we always think like, oh, they know what they're doing, but then, you know, quite often they don't. So they just test things, and then maybe it just doesn't work out. So in that sense, because they do it as an everyday thing, some of these work, some of these don't. So I studied these practices via 22 semi-structured interviews with hackers in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland that I recruited via a snowball sampling method. I chose this method because most interviewees valued anonymity to the extent that they did not want to reveal their name or their faces to me. So these classic face-to-face interviews was a no-go. So the qualitative interviews were also an important tool because they enabled me and the interviewees to deliberate together how and why their hacks come about. I could have, of course, also just studied different kinds of practices of hacking, but then I don't have the hacker's explanation as to what does this actually mean in your context? What do you want from this? Now, at this point, let me say a few things about digital methodology. Please start yawning when this becomes too boring, because I know that you all do digital methodology, but I feel like sometimes just to be on the same page, it's good to say something about what I mean by digital methodology. So if we want to study digital life, we also, to a certain extent, need digital methods. And here I was inspired when I read about, of course, developments in digital sociology. There's, of course, a classic form of studying digital aspects by using the proven and tested methods that we know from before, such as interviews and text analyses and observation and ethnography or statistical analyses about frequencies and correlations and so on. And all of this can tell us already quite a lot about a digital phenomenon, in my view. However, there's a whole new trend in social data science that says that we need to embrace the fact that we have all this digital networked information online and we need digital tools to study this information. I have taken a course in net scraping myself just to understand what these technologies allow me to see and what they don't allow me to see. And yet, I am not sure if digital tools are the only answer to doing digital sociology. Indeed, in some of my previous work, I found that simply using the information I find online, for example, scraping Twitter or whatever to just see how do people use Twitter under these and these circumstances, is by far not telling me what I am looking for. So I wanted to go digital by analyzing, for example, in my earlier studies, Facebook and Twitter data about how people on the 22nd of July attacks in Norway used social media for emergency management. Just looking at that data did not only confront me with serious research ethical challenges, but the data also didn't tell me what I wanted to know. I had to make interviews with the users to understand how did you use your Facebook account, what did you use it for, and so on. Or when I wanted to study policing software, I simply knew too little about programming to study the actual algorithms. So I had to acquire this knowledge via interviews with software engineers and studying the actual platforms. So nonetheless, I think studying digital phenomena requires that we bring our traditional research methods into the digital realm. What I mean is, if I want to follow a digital phenomenon, I need to let my statistics, my ethnography, my interviews, and so on, bring me there. Or if I say it with Rupert et al., studying digital phenomena still means that we need to get our hands dirty. and follow the phenomenon we want to study around, which also includes research in and on the digital realm. And by doing that, I will develop a certain digital literacy. I would say by now I can say something about algorithms. So I don't think we all need to start learning programming to study digital phenomena, but the study of a phenomenon will make you acquire digital competences. So now that this is out, I can say this is not always easy. For example, in my study of hackers, I thought that interviews would be the most giving method in terms of understanding their arguments about hacking online valence and so on. But in order to speak to them, I needed to install encrypted software on my work computer and chat programs and so on that made our poor IT administrator at my institute sweat. So, in order to find the hackers, I needed to use their preferred form of communication, which is for hackers defined by pretty nerdy tech solutions that are not sleek at all and are not really designed in terms of usability, right? So suggesting to them, like, we could have a Skype interview, right, was like an absolute nonsense. So some of them actually said yes to this, but most of them were actually, no, you're going to go there and there, and I tell you which kind of nerdy program you're going to download and install, and then we get to see whether this actually works. And some of them even denied to speaking to me in person. They only wanted to use kind of encrypted chat programs and so on. Well, I have much to say about this. So we see here that when we image search hacking, this is just a simple image search, the picture of hacking Google presents us with is apparently one of a character who wants to hide, stay in the dark, fake identity, stay anonymous, be activist, all these things. And in part, that reclusiveness showed itself in my study. I think this is bullshit, yeah, just to put it straight. But the reclusive image of the hacker did show itself in my study. Before I could speak to hackers, I had to pass some other tests. For example, in order to be deemed trustworthy enough, not I asked the hackers questions, but they questioned me. So some of them asked, what's the relationship between corporate surveillance and the state? Answer. And I was like, okay, right, I needed to answer. So in that sense, it's an active relationship of building trust so that these people actually decide to even continue the conversation with you. In some cases, I passed these tests. In others, I failed. And it's known amongst hackers as so-called, does anybody know this here? It's the social CAPTCHA test. If you want to access their culture, you have to pass this test first. I'm not a robot, right? The other variety of this test was to manage to install all these different software for communication. So I'm happy to discuss methodology in further Q&A sessions and so on, but for now, let's get back to explore Hager's ambiguous relationship to the internet and the way in which hacking is about both questioning but also reinventing current online structures. Now, to most hackers, the internet is a space that they partly build themselves, which creates a sense of ownership. At the same time, it is also an infrastructure that has traceability and valence deeply ingrained in its architecture. In fact, the internet is in its essence a self-surveilling digital network management machine born out of the need for managing shared data when we go back to the 40s and stuff. Thus, the internet is inseparable from surveillance. And one of the many characteristics of digital data is that it has to be traceable. So the interviews led me to understand how hackers stay in dialogue with the internet, but also shape it and challenge what has become of the internet. Now, if we look at online surveillance for a moment, indeed hackers find it impossible to find unsurveilled space online. Surveillance grows, they say, and this all comes out of my interviews. Surveillance grows in parallel to the steady development of new technologies, which makes it almost impossible to escape surveillance. And the threshold for accepting surveillance also sinks. This trend is reflected in political decisions and practices, they say. Most prominently, however, commercial actors change the practice of surveillance, as well as the steadily growing amounts of data exchange and available storage space that exists today. I guess I don't need to tell you that. You all know that. All of this supports politics of categorization, the effects of which we can see and study in society. And while surveillance has always existed, hackers observe the growing surveillance with suspicion, obviously. As interviewee Jay states, it's important one knows what happens and how technologies work in order to assess dangers and possibilities. Interviewees would refer to it as a conscious online behavior to reflect about what is private and what isn't. And this and similar quotes that you see here much describe the embedded situation of hackers who would not reject technologies per se. Rather, some of them would conduct cost-effort calculations to see which kind of online behavior makes sense. And instead of rejecting technologies, they would seek to, and here I quote again, craft with them, explore their borders, redefine their usage, and create added value with them. And I will give you a little introduction to how to hack now, or at least I will give you a little introduction of what they do and what some of them have actually described as hack acts. It starts all very easy, namely with data minimalism. To limit the amount of private information out there, as they said, also includes the covering of laptop cameras, and as we see even our friends Zuckerberg does it. So, not storing private data in cloud spaces and password protecting the hard disks of computers to go online, and I guess you all do all this yourselves probably. Most, but not all, hackers avoid the use of commercial service providers such as Google, Facebook, WhatsApp, or Dropbox. Encrypted and open source providers are the main alternative, and if such banal or banal forms of data minimalism are not a hack, I don't think they are exactly. They express at least awareness about surveillance online. And this awareness is often the origin of hacks that reduce the quantity and the quality of information available to corporate, public, and private surveillance. Rerouting and encrypting data. Many hackers communicate via overlay networks. Information is then rerouted through infrastructure that is added on top of existing network infrastructure. So since most overlay networks spread across the globe, it is difficult for a third party to watch the full string of connections through which a message is passed, right? So overlay networks can be self or custom made. They can also be used via open software such as the Onion Router, Tor. End-to-end encryption is another practice. Here, the standard format, we could say, of traveling information is hacked because messages are encrypted before sending and decrypted upon arrival, and only parties with the correct set of keys have access to the meaningful content of the messages. And such keys, of course, again, can be homemade. They can also be commercial. They can be open source. There's many different ways of doing this. Now we're coming to an area that Nissenbaum and Nissenbaum at least described as obfuscation. That's the idea of disappearing from view by hacking communication standards. And that's one of the, I think, the more forceful practices of dispute that do not discard of the internet as such. So who can find the three caterpillars on this right? No, it's apparently something that we have learned from the animal world. We can adapt certain forms of not being seen within the context where we don't want to be seen. And that's exactly what they play. So, because it is dispute uttered from inside the network, it builds upon the idea of opacity, of remaining unidentifiable. And glissants, anybody here is a literature studies person? No? But Glissant is has written an essay, Poetics of Relation, super hard to understand. But in essence, what he does is he describes opacity as the unknowability of people and the evasion of cognitive schema and standards that are generally used to govern people. Opacity is then a main force to challenge systems of domination from within. In the context of online communication, this also means not to become measurable. And how is that done? For example, through time-based obfuscation, as they like to call it. This means that one would generate large amounts of unimportant or incorrect data to let the original message disappear in access traffic. So I'm sending you something, probably most of those people who do these kinds of things, there might be some here in this room, know how this works. So you're sending this data, and then all this extra access traffic is generated, so it's really hard to pick out what it is that you're actually sending. There's also so-called ambiguating obfuscation, is to render the information about oneself consistently dubious by feeding browsers randomized or irrelevant data sets. So even though this is a very effective form of hacking communication standards, it's also really a lot of work. It delimits the user's freedoms because it has to be done constantly. In addition, one needs to know the surveillance algorithm specification in order to do it in a meaningful way. So if I want to avoid being categorized by Google, I can start kind of feeding Google lots of inconsistent information about me, but Google is also pretty fast in figuring out how to kind of update the algorithms in order to figure out what kind of pattern I'm using for feeding something, feeding their algorithms inconsistent data sets. And then also one can ask oneself, why am I online in the first place if I hide my identity? And then there's such a thing as selective obfuscation is yet a different method. It renders information understandable for authorized recipients only. So some, for example, mask their IDs or change their MAC address every time they start the computer. They use different locations online or have two handles in the same chat channel to write in with the same person. Some use riddle-based and other playful kinds of hacking communication standards that are only known to those who they communicate with. Yeah? These include lead speak, writing in symbols, and so on. We can go a step further here, for example, to diversify my hardware and creating parallel networks. That's different from Tor. It's starting to get a bit more geeky now. So dark boxes, for example, are second computers that are only used for data traffic, which is not supposed to be associated with the user. So I would have my second computer here, and that would be a dark box, and that is only used for the traffic that's not supposed to be associated with me. And then I would probably use all sorts of techniques of obfuscation for that computer to make sure people don't understand who I am. Others choose to start the computer's operation system completely from a stick, so that the system is not accessible to potential surveillers. Another practice is to share information through digital networks users have built themselves. Such networks run disconnected from the internet. Basically, they build their own internet. Here, files can be shared anonymously, but only locally. So us four here, we would have to be part of that same network in order to be able to share information with each other. And the creation of parallel networks can be interpreted as an attempt to fracture the internet's totality and to imagine, at least, alternatives outside the internet. But they still imagine dispute to come in a digital fashion. They don't go offline. And then, of course, we're arriving at these things that we generally read about in the papers, barricading, defacing, leaking, reverse engineering, those kinds of things. This last set of practices is different from the ones that I described above, since they move from a do not disturb, you know, to a we disturb you kind of activity, right? So we actively disturb those who surveil us. And concrete practices are distributed denial of service attacks, which makes online services unavailable by disrupting their traffic, by overloading websites. Other practices are web defacements, which change the visual appearance of a website, or leaks. For example, some hackers reverse engineer surveillance algorithms. They dedicate a computer to be a honeypot that attracts surveillance and spyware programs in order to analyze them and then understand how they work to protect oneself against such software, but also to exploit their most useful aspects against such software. So it's a very analytic geeky thing they would do. So in sum, we see quite a lot of different degrees ranging from what we would call a necessary response to surveillance power towards acts that by far not all hackers do, because they find active barricading too drastic. Which is actually also a criminal act. So, how can we understand these hacking practices as digital fabrication that is positive, progressive, that's a dispute of online surveillance? All of these practices exemplify the dynamics of back and forth that one can observe in disputing surveillance. Surveillance technologies are challenged by reappropriation, while those who reappropriate are well aware that such practice will not necessarily stop surveillance activities per se. And that's also not the point, again, of hacking. When we ask hackers themselves, what they consider their actions to be, the answer they have for their protection. But this doesn't exclude a role in disputing online surveillance. Part of that role is to act as a responsible, critical citizen, even if it is not, if it's a quiet form of protest that can sometimes disappear because we don't see it. Most importantly, practicing dispute is not a refusal to be part of the mainstream. Rather, many hackers express a wish that mainstream users were more aware of online surveillance. Hackers also see themselves as multipliers. Their role is to pass on knowledge and debunk myths, only to those people that they trust, maybe. But still, it's something that most of them have mentioned in some way. Both such actions can include leaks if necessary. Quite a lot of them were saying leaks are okay, but mainly ordinary practices such as sharing techniques or providing help with installations, those kinds of things. That makes hacking a lot less glamorous than it sounds, right? Another political dimension of hacking is also to be in control of one's own data or to increase the so-called value of one's data. For example, by making it more costly for surveillance to capture personal information. Whether noticed or not, such moments of dispute also function as their comments on socio-digital developments. And the above accounts underline that the evaluation of ethical and political violence of hacks are not only performed outside hacker cultures by scholars and policy experts, which we often read as scholars ourselves, right? But hackers critique and negotiate different kinds of hacks amongst each other and always in relation to the surveillance technology they want to dispute. Even though some hackers go to extreme lengths to dispute surveillance online, they also assess their investments with cost-benefit evaluations. They deliberate what they get out of their online behavior. What is the sensible amount of effort, time, and money to invest for which kinds of effects? So, what do we learn from this? Hacking is done for many purposes. Hacks have a practical, a technical, a self-serving, a political, a social, a playful dimension. Hacking interrogates existing practices and standards of valence. Neither are these moments of dispute a revolution, nor do they instantiate counterpower, a power outside a given system, since most of these practices still make use of online and network technologies. So instead of abandoning them completely, this form of dispute brings about new technologies and techniques. Hacking does not simply oppose values, techniques, and systems inherent in online surveillance, but it launches negotiations about what counts as an order of worth online. And these moments of dispute may not last long. They can actually be quite short because new dynamics of surveillance emerge. It should also not be forgotten that some hacking practices are themselves based on ethics or rationalities of surveillance. Yeah? Hackers surveil too. And disputing surveillance is then a practice that muddles the near dualisms of self-interest and common cause, destructive, constructive, legal, illegal, power, counterpower, and so on. So even if hacking only fabricates temporary windows of liberty or critique, they create small, potentially messy moments of disputing surveillance in its totality, which I suggest reconstitutes digital futures.